It is my pleasure to introduce to you Sarah Qualley, founder and president of Speak Life, a non-profit organization that provides online courses to educate, equip, and empower the pro-life movement. Sarah is an award-winning curriculum assessment and instructional designer and a gifted facilitator. She is passionate about unlocking the spiritual power of learning to help people stand for life according to their unique calling. Her topic, truth, compassion, and context, why learning is critical in engaging the culture.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. I survived the corporate world, and I survived higher education. Trust me, that's a lot to say. I want to talk to you today about... Sure. Is that better? Is that better? Okay. I'm off to the side here, so... Okay, there we go. I'm here to talk to you today about learning. So often we just intake messages every day, and we don't really understand how they permeate our minds, how they enter our hearts, how they enter our souls, actually. So I'm going to be talking about learning as a spiritual thing. And then I want to get very specific, and I want to talk about how learning has been corrupted, particularly in America. Our education system has done a lot to de-Christianize this nation. And I want to talk really specifically about what exactly has been done. Then I'm going to get into how we can reclaim that in the pro-life movement, apply that to the pro-life movement, and then talk about how we can start to take that back, because we can, and that's the good news. So I want to start by talking about learning as a process. Learning is the process of coming to know, believe, or develop a skill or become skilled at something. It's shaped by our intellectual capacities. It's shaped by our emotional capacities, as well as our personality traits, our learning styles, what we experience in life, how we were brought up. So learning really, it really encompasses everything we take in internally and externally. Getting some feedback. It also involves reinforcement and modification. So we take in so many things during the day that either reinforce what we believe or they challenge us. They challenge our beliefs. And in some cases, if we're willing, we start to modify what we think and what we know. Learning at its core is a spiritual thing. And a lot of people don't really think about what that means. At its very basic level, it is spiritual. Knowledge is a gift from God. It's a gift that he bestows upon creation. And to some, that comes in the form of instinct. And to other forms of creation, it comes in the form of being able to think and reason. But really, only to humans does he gift this ability to seek meaning and to develop a relationship, to desire a connection and a relationship with him. And so that is that spiritual nugget that's at the core of learning. Learning unlocks that ability, that desire, that connection with the Lord. And through prayer, it brings wisdom. And wisdom connects us to God. So you can start to see how that just flows through us. We are conduits through learning, through gaining knowledge. Wisdom then releases calling. And when we walk into our calling, we walk into our purpose, and then purpose exalts truth, and it glorifies God. So it's this wonderful circle that happens. So I would challenge you to think of learning in that way. So education is a formalized process of learning and teaching, and it has virtuous goals. The first goal is to pursue truth, obviously. When we learn something, we want to know the truth about something. And obviously, the definitive source of truth is God's word. Another goal of education, a virtuous goal of education, is to establish meaning and purpose. Now, this comes directly from the process of creation. Life has meaning. Things are designed for a purpose in God's kingdom. Another goal of education is to produce ideas and solutions for the betterment of society. And these ideas and solutions have integrity. They have moral measurability because God is the measuring rod. And that's a really important component. So for this reason, education really is, I think, the first line of defense in a nation. And where there's a first line of defense, there's a first line of attack. And that is certainly what education has been in America. Typically across the world, education is withheld as a means to control people. But in America, it's been infiltrated and used. And that's a big difference, and it's important to recognize that difference. This really is a battle for the mind and the soul of humankind. The infiltration into education is a battle between light and darkness. It's a battle between good and evil. It's a very dramatic way to say it, but I want to break it down and make it a little more practical for you. So there are two main ways that learning, that education, has been corrupted. The first is this idea of absolute truth versus relativism. Now, at the core of this, the question is, what is moral truth and where does it come from? Now, relativism says everyone's truth is their own truth. Everyone's belief is their own belief. None are wrong. None are right. They just are. To deny someone their truth is to deny yourself yours. And there it is. The component of self. That component of self is always at the heart of relativism. Another way that education has been infiltrated, sort of this other basic idea, is the individual versus the collective. And in this case, the question is, where do rights come from and where do we derive our value? Those are very important questions. So these are very basic building block ideas in a society. And all ideas have consequences. All bear fruit, good or bad, right? But it's the roots that we really have to deal with. We have to get beyond the surface and really look at what's happened and where these roots are coming from. So I want to examine for a few minutes the roots that have corrupted learning in America. I want to be very specific about it. So when progressivism came into America about the 1890s, it brought with it several roots. One of them was something called utilitarianism, and that basically says that your value is derived from what you can produce in society. Another root was Malthusianism, which said there is this horrible overpopulation crisis in the world, and humans are contributing negatively on the planet, and so our population has to be reduced. Another root was positivism, and positivism basically says we can't know truth unless we can touch and measure it, right? And then the fourth big root, I think, underneath this tree is obviously humanism, and that's man playing God. So you start to bring all of those things together, and progressivism really brought that into America at the turn of the century. So these roots were first planted in the universities. They first came into higher education, and from there, they went out into government, science, medicine, the media, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the church. They basically put tentacles everywhere and just went all through society planting other roots so that they could grow up into the system that we recognize and sort of feel and know around us every day. So let's look at the goals of these roots. These goals are very different than the virtuous goals that I just mentioned. The first goal is to disconnect children from spiritual authority. Now, this is obviously God, and this is their parents. The second goal is to socially reconstruct and reform. Now, this was a deliberate shift that happened in education in the 1930s. They went from really bringing out potential in a child in the classroom and turning the classroom into a collective experiment and really bringing children, using the classroom as a vehicle for social change. That was a really big thing. It was called social reconstructionism, and it was a move of education during that time. The other goal is to, of course, embed relativism, embed situation ethics, embed
relative morality. And this, too, was a deliberate shift, deliberate move in education about the 1960s, when there was a lot of work done to secularize America. So what that's basically resulted in, obviously, is a broken compass. It's a lot of people walking around without very much direction today. Another goal was to make absolute truths subjective. Now, the Benham brothers talked about this a little bit. The three things that have really been under attack are life, love, marriage, and our freedoms, freedom of religion, freedom to be able to speak our mind, the constitutional freedoms that come from our Creator, not from government. Another goal is to teach what to think, not how to think. Now, this is a little more subtle, and it tends to happen over a longer period of time. But what I'm talking about here is really removing critical thinking in the search for knowledge. Critical thinking, basically, you can break it down and really consider it asking questions, questioning assumptions, really looking at bias, going beyond face value, debating, having an opinion, really looking at things from different perspectives. We've lost that. We've completely lost that in America. You can't say anything without being torn down, personal attacks, name-calling. It's ridiculous at this point. We've just totally thrown out civility. And that's been a deliberate thing, because when you start to think critically, you can actually get to the truth. So why is this important for us to know right now? I think it's because in order to properly do battle, in order to enter the spiritual battle and also the worldly battle that we fight every day, we have to understand what the culture of death is, where it comes from, what its goals are, how it came here, how its roots have manifested over time, and how the body of Christ absolutely must respond to it in this current day. So right now I want to take what I've been talking about and start to move it down into the pro-life movement particularly. How does spiritual learning, how does the corruption of learning apply to life issues? How does it apply to what we experience and know every day? Obviously, a lot has been accomplished over a very long period of time. We're not just talking about 1973 with the legalization of abortion. We're talking about going way back. What does that look like? Let's call it out by name. First of all, the measuring rod has been removed. God has been removed from our institutions, from our conversations about life. It's how abortion proponents can claim that an unborn child is not human or valuable, but its parts are. It's that hypocrisy, that craziness, that disconnection that happens in the mind. C.S. Lewis warned us about this. He said, unless the measuring rod is independent of the things measured, we can do no measuring. I think that's very true. Another thing that's been accomplished, particularly in the pro-life movement, is relativism is now the new moral ground. It's how exceptions to abortion are made acceptable in society. In a macro view, it's how Islamic violence against women is tolerated. So you have cultural relativism, and you have relativism on a small scale, just in individual conversations you have with people. Also, ethics are situational. We know this very well. It's how things like aborted fetal research, embryonic stem cell research, fetal anomaly, assisted suicide, it's how all of those things are made to be something that's altruistic, because our ethics are not grounded anymore. It depends, is sort of the answer that the medical community tends to have. So truth has been corrupted in order to force change upon our society. And this is something that's not new at all. This is something that historically has been happening in the world for thousands of years. But I want to look specifically at a strategy known as the Hegelian dialectic. Does anybody here know what that is or have heard of that before? Excellent. It was brought to America by the progressives, among many other wonderful things, at the turn of the 19th century. And it was brought to us by a German philosopher named George Hegel. And he actually influenced famous thinkers like Karl Marx, like Nietzsche, like Freud. So he was very influential in his time. And what he did is he said, humans are uncomfortable with the truth. We have conflict with the truth. And we know that to be true. We know that truth is uncomfortable. We don't like to look at ourselves a lot. We don't like to take that in and really look at what's going on sometimes. But what he said was that to resolve that conflict with truth, that the truth has to be integrated with its contradictions in order to form a higher knowledge. So in order for humans to play God, basically, we have to know more by integrating untruths into the absolute truth. So again, tearing down the notion of absolute truths. So this is what the Hegelian dialectic does to truth. I want to look very specifically at this. So the truth is proposed as a thesis. So I'm going to give you an example to help clarify. So the truth here is that fetal anomaly doesn't change the value of life. So for every truth, there is an opposite view, of course, and that's the lie. Hegel calls it the antithesis. And here, it's that fetal anomaly is incompatible with life. Now that seems pretty cut and dry. They're opposite of each other, right? But what he does is he says, if we take a piece of that lie and we blend it with the truth, we have a synthesis, a new truth. And that truth is the severity of fetal anomaly can affect the quality of life. So if this was compartmentalized and kept to this level, we could probably argue pretty good about this, right? We could talk about this with somebody. But the problem with this is that synthesis that you see at the top becomes the new thesis. It becomes the new truth. And it grows. So this is what happens over time. There's the truth, way down at the bottom. It starts to branch out. Imagine this filling up the room. Imagine it filling up the room next door that we were all in this morning. Imagine it filling up the hotel. Imagine it filling up Cleveland. This is the magnitude of how the truth has been corrupted in the pro-life movement, in any movement for truth, really, in any situation that's coming up against God's truth. This is what has happened. And it's interesting to me to look at this visually because the jig is up. I mean, this is really how this has been done. So that new synthesis is seen as that higher level of truth. It's seen as suddenly this compromise, right? Political correctness. That's where that comes from. That's where that originates. We're now more comfortable talking about it because suddenly we're compassionate or we've come to this higher level of knowledge. But that's not really truth. It's just stuck in the cycle. So I want to show you now what happens on a broad scale, right? The filling up Cleveland level of this stuff manifesting over time. It actually has a name. It's called the problem-reaction-solution model. So it starts with an agenda. So in this case, to advance abortion. That's our agenda, right? The people with the agenda manufacture a crisis. They create a problem. In the 1960s, the crisis was that there were 10,000 women dying every year from illegal abortion. Completely untrue. But it was something that was put out there by NARAL. Bernard Nathanson, actually, the founder of NARAL, came out later and said that that was a complete fabrication. He couldn't believe the media bought it, but it helped them to serve their cause. So that's the crisis. Oh my goodness. Look at all these people that are dying from illegal abortion. But then those that manufacture that crisis, or actually sometimes they'll exploit one that does truly exist. That's another tactic. They use propaganda to create a reaction, a very strong emotional reaction from the public. And then they blame someone for the crisis. So in this case, what a shocking statistic. 10,000 women, can you believe that? That's happening? Who is to blame for this? It's the people that are standing up against the legalization of abortion. It's those pro-lifers. They're causing this problem. We have to have sympathy for the women. They're so desperate. They're in situations that they're in such despair that they're coming, they're having to seek out abortions, they're dying because it's not safe. So the people that manufacture the crisis, create the reaction in the public, and then blame someone, have the solution ready. And in this case, it's to legalize abortion to make it safe for women. So you see how this can start to work. The public readily accepts the solution because it saves them from the crisis. And it saves them from the people who are causing it. Us. Right? So when you look at what's happened to our country through this lens, I think you get an idea of what we're up against. This doesn't just apply to the pro-life movement. This applies to everything that our country faces today. This is basically how it was done. And I would encourage you and challenge you to think about that as you go and just be every day and see things on the news and see things in the media and just really recognize that this has been going on for a long time and that the truth that's presented to you is not truth at all. It's a very, very watered down version of the truth that's sort of been through a grinder, if that makes sense. So how else does the corruption of learning apply to the pro-life movement? We've seen a couple things now. Obviously, there is a battle between information and integrity. I think really at no time in the history of humankind have we had more information available to us than we do right now. But most of that information isn't truth. There really is no integrity. It is a nugget of the truth sort of reapplied in a different context. It's sometimes a straight up lie. Sometimes it's really the result of the Hegelian dialectic. It's just the end of that stream. We also see very often the battle between facts versus opinion emotions. And this is a really big one. It's how I think definitive science on human development can be completely tossed aside because of someone's feelings in a particular situation. It doesn't matter. Again, this really is the result of the Hegelian dialectic. So what do we do about this, right? How can we actually face up to this thing that's been created? We have to understand the culture of death, I think, in context, for sure. We have to understand the history of this. We need to know the cultural implications. We've got to know this is a vast system. But we don't want to be intimidated by it because we know this system has demonic roots. And that if we expose those roots, we can have victory for sure. We can reclaim spiritual learning, that beautiful circle that I talked about at the beginning. We just need to align ourselves with the truth. We can consult the truth. We can see the bigger picture. And we can open up that communication channel again between us and God so he can speak to us directly about how we are supposed to use the gifts and talents that he has given us to stand up and to stop this. That's a very important communication channel that we have to have open. So I want to look now at why context is so critical. Context is critical, obviously, in understanding unbiased, evidence-based truth. This is not my truth. This is not your truth. This is truth that's based on facts that stand the test of other facts. This is the Word of God. Context is also critical in developing godly, not worldly compassion. So looking at emotional, controversial issues that we're facing right now through God's eyes and with his heart for people. Context is also key in being able to critically consume all of the information that's coming at us all day long, questioning assumptions, detecting bias, trying to see that big picture. If I have this article, this thing that I learned from my friend, where does that go? Where does that go in what I know? How do I bring all of that together? And everything really is connected. It really is. So it's also important, context is so critical, in equipping ourselves to stand uniquely. Again, knowing that the gifts and talents that God has given us and starting to bring in that knowledge, starting to bring in the context that we're learning and opening up that channel of communication with him to really start to stand up. So without context, just for some visualization, for those of you who are visual people, we're like a 1,000-piece puzzle that's been thrown on the floor with no picture on the box. It's kind of a good way to think of where we are without context. We see the tip of the iceberg without context. We don't see what's looming underneath, all the danger there. Without context, we repeat horrible atrocities that we said we would never repeat again. So, without context, we do repeat history. We neglect the spiritual battlefield. We don't recognize abortion and euthanasia and all of these issues as God issues. As at their core, it's an issue of value. It's not an issue of politics, right? Abortion is a God issue. Without context, we drown in arguments that don't account for the philosophical foundations that I introduced to you earlier. If we don't understand that somebody is a relativist, we can talk all day long about the value of life, and we might as well be speaking French, because they're coming from a whole different worldview than we are. And we need to know that context. We need to understand what that is and how to speak into it. We also operate in ignorance of who the enemy really is and who we are to stop him. We forget about our authority. We don't recognize that we have the authority to stand up. Biblically, we are given that, and we need to be responsible and use that. Without context, we allow evil to flourish. Now, this is different than being apathetic, because apathy certainly will allow evil to flourish. But what also allows evil to flourish, again, is not knowing who the enemy is, how he's done this, where he comes from, what he's bringing with him, how he's started to tear down America, how he's really tried to remove God. We need to understand that context, or we really are up against a monster. I like this quote from the 5th century BC from Sun Tzu. He was a Chinese general. He wrote The Art of War. He says, if you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles. If you know yourself and not the enemy, for every victory gained, you will also suffer a defeat. If you know neither the enemy nor yourself, you will succumb in every battle. That's powerful. So what does it look like when we have context? Let's flip this on its end. We are better prepared for our daily walk, not only in the pro-life movement, but just daily being a Christian, walking out our faith. We can climb outside of issues. We know that abortion is not a political issue. It's not a women's issue. It's not a healthcare issue. If it's any issue, like I said, it's a God issue. We can also reject the lies that have been accepted as truth. Those lies that are the result of that system that's been churning, that Hegelian dialectic that I introduced. And a lot of these lies are readily accepted by the pro-life movement because they sound okay, or because we're not really sure what the truth is, or because we don't have context. So when we have context, we can reject those lies. We can operate in wisdom instead of ignorance. And again, I mentioned earlier, wisdom is how your calling is released. It's how we clear that channel. It's how we hear from God. It's how we walk into the path he has for us to stand up for life. I heard the other day, I want to share this kind of funny with you. It struck me. But the difference between knowledge and wisdom, because sometimes those get mixed up. Knowledge is knowing a tomato is a fruit, and wisdom is knowing not to put it in a fruit salad. So that kind of explains it, I think, pretty well. So with context, we can discern truth. We can start to ask those bold questions. We can see bias. We can start to bring people towards the truth that really don't know it, that haven't really seen it. We have such an opportunity right now for that to happen with the Delighten videos this summer. There really are a lot of people that are going, wait, what is abortion? What's been going on? What are we condoning? I mean, it's really awakened a lot of people, even pro-choice people that have stood with Planned Parenthood that are really starting to question, you know, what do I really think? What are my values? what an opportunity we have right now to bring those people in and to really speak truth to them and help them understand. We can develop and strengthen our godly compassion. We can give biblical answers to those horribly tough questions like rape and incest and life of the mother and all the things that get thrown up at us, those emotional arguments. And we understand that there is a difference between how the world views compassion and a difference between how God views it. We can really make a difference in helping people understand why life is so important and why it's so valuable. We can speak and act out of love, not judgment, not condemnation. This is so important. It's the number one mistake that Christians make. I see it all the time on social media in particular. But really trying to speak truth to someone, they're reacting in a bad way. Immediately the reaction from a Christian is to act in a bad way, to name call, to go right down there. And we can't do that. We've got to stay above that. We've got to really try to act out of God's heart for people and really know what that is. And we know that because, again, we can clear the static. We can push away all that noise that our culture puts in front of us all day long. And we can be in prayer. We can be in conversation. We can understand what it is that He wants us to do. So this is good. I think that God uses our knowledge, enriched and empowered by context, to speak to us about our purpose. And that question really that God asks us is, I've given you these gifts and talents uniquely for you. Let me show you how to use them, how to walk with me to learn exactly how I want you to go forward. And that, of course, takes faith, and that takes a listening ear, it takes prayer. It takes a lot of faith, actually. But really He does. He uses knowledge. He uses that context. He uses our knowledge of the bigger picture to really understand, how He wants us to stand up. So I want to just take a minute to talk a little bit practically again and talk about what context looks like. What does it look like when we have context in a particular situation? Operating in wisdom, knowing the truth, having that godly compassion, knowing the context about something. I want to take the life of the mother exception as an issue right now. Former presidential candidate Chris Christie made a statement about life not too long ago. He said, "I am pro-life. I believe in exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. That's my position. Take it or leave it." So how many of you have heard someone take that position? Raise your hand. You know, or taken that position yourself in the past, or take it now. This is a tough one. But what does it look like when we know the truth, when we have compassion, when we have context that we need to speak into this issue? I want to talk about that. The life of the mother exception was actually born out of eugenics in the 1930s, in the Great Depression. And what they were trying to do then, and eugenics were very prominent back in the 30s. In fact, there was a Supreme Court case called Buck v. Bell in the later 30s that made mandatory sterilization constitutional in the United States. And it opened up the floodgates for almost all the states to have some kind of sterilization, mandatory forced sterilization law against the unfit populations. And so this is the climate that we're talking about. The abortion industry at that time was still illegal, right? They were operating in plain view in a lot of the bigger cities. But what they were trying to do was start to push the legalization issue forward. And they said, look at all these mothers in poverty with many children. If we would allow abortion for in cases of life of the mother because they can't afford, you know, their children are sick, they're dying, the women are dying, just really preying on the emotions. We need to weed out the unfit populations. We need to help the mothers that are struggling in the depression with having too many children. So we need to understand that that is where life of the mother came from. And that was right before penicillin was introduced in the 1940s, which actually took the death rate from illegal abortion and dropped the bottom out of it. A lot of people think, or the lie has been put out there that Roe v. Wade dropped the death rate from abortion, but that's not true at all. It was actually 1942 when penicillin was introduced into the abortion procedure. And we went from hundreds of women dying to, I think, down in the 40 or 50 a year. So it really made a difference. But this is before that. And so having that context, too, is important. So this is a really big heartstring issue. I heard just the other day someone presented to a husband, if you had to choose between your wife and your unborn child, what decision would you make? And I'm here to say that that's an absolute false choice, because the life of the mother issue is a myth. And let me tell you what I mean by that. So in the first trimester of pregnancy, there are two situations where the life of the mother's health might be threatened. One is ectopic pregnancy, and one is a very serious uterine infection. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce the medical name for it right now. But those two situations, what a doctor will do is he will go and he will treat whatever is happening. So he will treat the ectopic pregnancy. He will treat the infection. He is not there to kill an unborn child. The primary goal of an abortion procedure is to kill an unborn child. The primary goal of treating an ectopic pregnancy is not that. The primary goal of treating a systemic infection is not that. So when you climb into the second and third trimester, you have health issues like high blood pressure, like placenta previa, like possible hemorrhage. There are a number of things that can really acutely threaten the life of the mother, and that's an emergency situation. But when you understand that abortion at that gestation takes 2 or 3 days to prepare the woman for the abortion, you understand that abortion is absolutely useless in that situation. In fact, it would kill her, because she would have to be prepared so long, the cervix would have to be dilated so much to abort a child of that gestation. And so again, primary goal of abortion is to kill the unborn child. That is not the primary goal of saving a mother's life when she has a life-threatening health condition. That doctor is going to try to save both. He's going to try to save both. And so when you look at it that way, what we've done is we've taken this idea of life of the mother, and that was the camel's nose under the tent back in the 30s, and we've sort of left that door open for all these years, and we're convinced that it has to stay. It's not even real. It's not even real from a scientific and medical standpoint. And so that's what I mean by knowing the truth about something, being able to speak to the emotional side of this, and then having that context of history and what it really is in the medical field to have abortion, understanding that primary goal argument when we talk about medical procedures. Does that make sense? Okay. So the point I wanted you guys to take away from this session is that these three things, truth, compassion, and context, are so, so important when we talk about reclaiming that corruption that's happened, really reclaiming that spiritual aspect of learning to hear from God and walk into our purpose in standing for life. So just to recap, before we start the question period, what can we do? We can seek truth in God's word and in factual evidence. We can differentiate between godly and worldly compassion. That's so important, being able to answer those tough questions, being able to talk about what the Bible says about life, how God feels about the purpose he creates each life for. We can learn to discern through prayer, through having just a conversation when we are faced with truths and untruths. And we can be a disciplined context seeker. I like that. I want to pray for each one of you to really and challenge you to become that every day, to just not take things at face value and start to ask really tough questions, even the questions that put you down the road that make you face your own beliefs, put you up against the things that you've just sort of known or learned over time and not really thought about. But does that align with the answers I'm getting? Am I finding something that aligns with that? Am I aligning with God's word? Do I understand the truth? And then in some cases, being able to go and say, you know what, I got to start over. I was wrong. This isn't right. And then building that up again, using the truth and using context, trying to look at the bigger picture. So I'm going to take questions here. I'm actually right on time. Wow. So what I've done, but before I start taking questions, in the back on the table back there, I've put some information about what Speak Life does and how we facilitate this kind of contextual learning. And there's information about our curriculum right now. So before you leave, make sure you pick that up. And I have a little card for you too, just to kind of tuck in your pocket. But basically our current curriculum right now takes the issue of abortion and it puts it in the context of the de-Christianization of America over the last 120 years. So really looking at things like the Hegelian dialectic, diving into, you know, what has happened to America? How has God been removed? What does that mean? How did evil rise up? And really giving you a very comprehensive view of how we got here and then what we can do about it. So thank you. I'll start to take questions. Yes, are rape and incest exceptions examples of the Hegelian dialectic? Absolutely they are. Yeah, because I think the original thesis, the original truth, is that all life is valuable in all circumstances, no matter what. But you start to pick away at that over time, and you get things like rape and incest exceptions, because no matter how life is conceived, it is still from God. Even in the most broken way, that is still a purpose-filled life. But we've gotten so far away from that truth because of that dialectic happening. Absolutely. And then the person who wrote this question mentioned the Buck v. Bell. The justice on the Supreme Court on that case is famously quoted as saying, three generations of idiots are enough. So in his decision for that, it was actually Carrie Buck was the subject of that case. And it if you look at the truth again, of that case, she actually was a victim of a rape. And they looked at her, they looked at her daughter, and they did some kind of intellectual testing that was available at that time, and they graded her as an imbecile. And those words meant something very specific at that time in eugenics. And it came out later that they were not at all. In fact, her daughter excelled in school, and she was not at all mentally incapacitated in any way. She had no learning disabilities. There's nothing wrong with this woman, but they wanted to hold that up and push that through. It sort of reminds me of what they did to Jane Roe. That is really how that type of thing gets pushed through. So yes. Okay, this person says, clearly we talk two different languages, Christianity and the secular world. How can we effectively engage persons talking the other language? We speak truth and love, but we're still talking different languages. And, you know, I think it's interesting because the language that we can speak is love. It's really hard to argue with someone who even doesn't believe in God that there is love and that it's a powerful force. To them, it's very emotional. It's an emotional pull. To us, yes, it's emotional too, but we understand that it's grounded in God's law. It's who God is. He is love. But we can't really explain that to people without trying to convert them, right? So what we can do is speak about love. We can speak about respect. We can speak about human dignity. We can speak about valuable things. We can go with logic. We can start to think, you know, ask questions. If this is valuable then, why isn't it valuable now? Challenge people's thinking. For me, what I find is the number one thing, I think the number one response to someone who is pushing back at any kind of pro-life or any kind of pro-God view on anything, is to turn the tables and start asking them questions. That is such a good strategy. Instead of feeling like you have to defend it and feeling embarrassed and maybe, I don't know, I can't think of any scriptures right now, I can't, you know, really just getting flustered, I think the thing to do really is to say, well, why do you feel that way? Well, what about this? What about this situation? And just really start to lead the conversation and make them defend their beliefs. Make them defend the logic. And what you'll find pretty quickly is that there isn't any logic there. And you expose that. And then you can speak in a gentle way to instruct them, pull them towards the truth. And I think that is God's way. You know, we are to gently instruct. We are to be good stewards of the truth. We're not to quarrel. He talks about that several places in the Bible. So I think that having that love language really landing on that is a good place to start, and asking questions and making people defend their belief systems. That's good. Can this be applied to issues such as Black Lives Matter? Oh, yes. So there is a long, long history, and I was just looking at this the other day. We actually cover this in one of our courses about the 30s. There is a seed that was planted that actually grew into Black Lives Matter currently, and it was a seed of communism that was planted in the black community about the 1930s. And if you track that all the way up, you can see how the Hegelian dialectic, again, was really used to pull the Black community away from the church, away from their spiritual roots, to really start to kind of turn them away and say, you know what, the government is who can help you. Communism, we can fight for you. It was a violent revolution, and that got pulled into some of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And some of that is still alive today, and we're seeing it sort of manifest again. We're seeing it rise up again in that movement, but that is a seed that was planted a long time ago that's just being watered again now. And it's being watered by sort of this corruption. We don't remember that. We don't know. There's such a broad and deep history on the political parties of the Black community, on slavery. I mean, there's just so much truth that's not out there that people don't know. David Barton has a great book. How many of are you familiar with David Barton? I really respect him. He has a book called, I think it's America in Black and White. It's not the exact title. But it's a real thin book. I think you get it on Amazon for like $7. It's really cheap. But it really digs back into the history of Black America and what's happened, and through the political parties, and why Republicans were sort of with the Black community then, and how that changed and why that changed. And really explains a lot of what's going on now. But the Black Lives Matter movement surely is, to me, as I look at the context of history, is just really a fruit of communism. It really is. Oh, yeah. I'm going to take a drink of water for this one. Each of us asks ourselves this question every day. How do we begin to state the truth when there is so much negative emotion, anger, and vitriol by the opposition? Yes. So, ooh, I have 2 minutes. I'm going to tell a really quick story that I think illustrates my answer to this question. So I've been a sidewalk prayer supporter for a number of years, and there was one time in my career, if you want to call it that, of praying in front of abortion facilities in Minneapolis and St. Paul, that I thought I was going to get hit in the face. And I was standing on the sidewalk, and this guy just pulled in with such vigor, squealed his wheels, got out, came towards me, and I literally set my body because I thought he was going to punch me. That's how angry he was. And he said, "How dare you? How dare you shame these women?" And was just blah, blah, you know. And of course, I was scared. You know, I had people with me, but I was scared. It was me. I just happened to be the only one standing in that particular part of the sidewalk. And I let him speak. And I just, through Holy Spirit, just said, okay, do I run? Is this a situation where I'm going to be harmed? And I heard, stay. I said, okay. So I listened and I let him, I just let him be angry. I let him speak. And it ended up being a conversation on viability. And it ended up that he had had a premature baby that was 26 weeks when she was born, and they have problems, and he was angry about that. And he was angry that the doctors had told him to abort when he loves his child. We started to get into this conversation again because I started asking him questions. And then I said, well, you think about your own child. Really, viability, what does that even mean? Viability is not a measure of life. Viability is a measure of medical technology capabilities. It has moved. Back in 1973, viability was 28 weeks. It's now almost 21. 7 weeks. We have moved the line. This is a moving target. It's not about life. Viability is also, you know, whether or not a hospital wants to spend money on NICU services for a child. A lot of times they will pull those. There's a lot of things involved, but it's not about life. And so I explained that to him, and we talked about it, and his whole demeanor changed. And let me tell you, by the end of that 5 minutes that we were talking, we were praying for this man. We were praying for him. Is there something we can pray for you? Yes. I just lost my job. Oh. I don't know how we're going to afford to take care of our baby who's sick. He was born prematurely. It's God's heart, you guys. We need to tap into that. We need to know. We need to hear. We need to listen. It's so noisy. It's so noisy today. We've got to listen to people. Sometimes you just got to let people vent. You know, sometimes I want to vent because I'm sick of it. I'm tired and frustrated. But we are spiritual warriors for the King, and that's why we are here. That's why we're gathered here today. That's our calling. That's our calling. Thanks.
You've been listening to Sarah Qualley, the founder and president of Speak Life, and a 2016 Bringing America Back to Life Convention speaker.